Welcome, everyone. We'll begin with a bow. This is Module 18, Class 1, and we are beginning to work with the Heart Sutra. This is the book, The Heart Attack Sutra by Carl Brunholz. If you need to get it, I think, Michael, do you still have copies? Or
I only ordered one.
Just one.
Copy.
Okay, so you can get it online or in Kindle, whatever you want. So the four teachers here were on a retreat last week. And so one thing that I realized when we had our little discussion group, we had discussion groups every day to talk about what we were learning. The leader of my group, she started every discussion with basically refuge and bodhicitta. So I would like to do that because we're actually beginning a whole new teaching cycle with the Heart Sutra. So I'd just like to take a moment for us to feel this sense of appreciation for the teachings. And to remember, and we'll be studying this more, the Buddha as an example of someone who attained realization, and also the Sangha, the community of practitioners, as important in helping us along the path. And those are the components of refuge, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And bodhicitta, rousing bodhicitta, is really rousing our heart of compassion. And that is thinking of others and thinking how whatever we learn in the teachings can be of benefit to other people, to ourselves and other people. Hi, have you been here before?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Leslie.
You're Leslie.
Yes.
Good. Let's make bring up a chair. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good. Very. You're welcome. Okay. Here's an extra copy.
Thank you.
Welcome, Leslie. So we just began this class. We are in Module 18, Class 1. So I think we could all hold that aspiration in our heart, why we are meditating, why we're learning about the Dharma. It's not just for ourselves. It's actually so that we can be of benefit to others. So tonight, I would like to begin. Tonight the topic is the introduction to the Heart Sutra. So I just would like to begin the zoom out. I like to have some kind of overview here and see it from kind of the whole or the bigger picture. And really, this teaching is really different because it's not so much that we're presenting material, it's more that you're working with a text to discover it on your own. That only through your own kind of pursuit to understand what the Heart Sutra means will it actually be revealed to you. So at first it seems rather obscure, and as you work with it more, it starts to come alive, I think. Do people have a copy of the Heart Sutra, and do you need to look at it while we're going? Does everybody... Leslie, do you need a copy?
I think I do.
Okay. Okay,
there you go.
Thank you.
So this is very personal, this journey, working with the Heart Sutra. And I have to say that questions are more important than answers. So we're not going to go through a list of this and that. It's going to be a real question about what is this about? And it's your own questions, your frustrations, your confusion. This is all part of the process of actually uncovering the deeper truth of this teaching. So there is a surface level explanation, but hidden within that is a much deeper meaning. And as I said, discovering what that is for you individually is really your own path to realization. So this is a journey, and it's a very individual journey. I guess I should say a few words about the Heart Sutra, because some people may not be too familiar with it. And I'm not going to go through the Heart Sutra. We're going to take several classes on this, so others will be doing that. But this was a teaching that was given in India, and the Buddha gave basically this teaching through his presence. So it's the really the deepest teaching of what's called the Mahayana. But before I say anything, actually, the whole point of this was my questions. Not to talk, but to let you talk. So the first question is, number one, in one word, or maybe two words, what is the Heart Sutra about? Yes?
I'd say progression.
Progression. Anybody else?
Emptiness.
Emptiness.
No.
No.
I would say emptiness.
Emptiness?
Awakening.
Awakening? Who said that? Oh, awakening?
Non-attachment.
Prajna.
Prajna?
Knowing.
Mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
Letting go.
Also, yes.
Reconciling opposites.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, hold that thought. Well, if we took two words, I would say it's about emptiness and compassion. Those are the two central teachings. But obviously, prajnaparamita is in the title, and Michael will be talking more about that next time, which points the way to emptiness. So actually, everything people said is correct. There's a lot of meaning behind the teaching. So this chant, this is actually a chant, and it's really meant to be spoken out loud. You can read it, but I think you would understand. I think you get the point when if you just read it to yourself, it's really different from chanting it together. And there's something about using your voice and also hearing the drum. So a number of you were here at the movie we showed on Enlightenment Guaranteed. And does anyone want to say anything about the Heart Sutra?
So it's just almost an absurdist, but it's a great movie. And like the very quick plot summary is these two German guys who are brothers go to Japan, lose everything, and then go to a monastery, which was why they went there, and spend a few weeks. And then when they leave, all they have left is a little tent, and they go back to Tokyo, and they camp in some park in their little tent. And then they say, oh, I love the chanting. Let's chant the Heart Sutra. And so this little tent in a park, and the people next to them are playing tennis. They're chanting the Heart Sutra.
In Japanese.
With the gongs and everything in the background, as if they're in the monastery. It's just this amazing, like...
And we know where they are by the gongs.
Right.
Yes.
Where they are in the thing, because that's not Japanese.
Right.
We don't know otherwise.
Right.
But it's sort of... And just it was sort of really, that's like like their groundlessness, like all they have. Literally, I think all they have is like a flashlight in the tank.
Right, because they lost their credit card in the machine because they couldn't understand the Japanese. And
I know credit cards,
they ate one card and then the other side.
The taxi took them to the wrong place.
The taxi didn't,
but so their passports were at a hotel.
They couldn't get back to the hotel. They didn't speak Japanese. They didn't have a name of the hotel. The whole thing was just
and the tent
one
is actually,
loss.
They paraded into a department store and just stole it.
All they had was a tent and they slept in the park. So, yeah. So actually that movie is a lot about groundlessness.
Yeah,
totally. It's a like, wonderful introduction to the Heart Sutra. And then the Heart Sutra is, you hear it when they're in the monastery and you hear the gong and the drum and the... The Heart Sutra is really, you get the feel of it within that environment. And it's something you can do on your own if you wish. And it's online. You can print it out. There's a copy online. So you're welcome to do it in your daily practice if that's something you'd like to do.
Can you get a karaoke version of it?
Karen, I want to see you do it.
That's awesome.
You can record one of these.
You can do your own drumming, please.
You can do your own thing. Yeah, yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
There's an app for everything.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, you can get the Heart Sutra app.
Some translations of the Heart Sutra are different, though.
Yeah, there are different translations. So the one that we're using here in the chants that we do, it's translated by Trungpa Rinpoche's students, and he supervised this translation. And this the translation in the Heart Attack Sutra is by Carl Brunholz, and it's in the back. And he doesn't call it Vulture Peak Mountain, for instance.
Right.
He calls it, what does he call it? Vulture Flock Mountain.
Right.
So that's a different translation. Right. So, you'll find different translations. But actually, the one we used this weekend, I was very surprised. The teacher that taught this retreat, Pema Kalaya retreat, this is our translation. Did you notice that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that was really
Nalanda
interesting.
Bodhi? Yeah, the Nalanda Bodhi one was the same.
The Nalanda Bodhi is the same as the one we're using, and also the teacher, Kilong Rinpoche, took that translation. So it's one that a lot of teachers use. But no, I think Anam Thubten's is slightly different.
Yeah,
I think it's a little different. Okay. All right, so let's go on to question two. Buddhist teachings speak of three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. What are these three turnings, and where does the Heart Sutra fit in these teachings?
Is that the Hinayana and Mahayana? Is that what you mean?
What's that?
Is it the Hinayana and Mahayana?
That's
what you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember it was in the second.
Vajrayana.
It was in the second.
So
this is in the Mahayana.
So
actually the Vajrayana.
No, the Vajrayana part actually of the Mahayana, actually.
Oh.
So the three turnings are different from the three yanas. And I just want to show you something. If you see portraits of the Buddha that has this mudra, this represents turning the wheel of Dharma. And turning the wheel of Dharma means giving the Dharma teachings, giving the teachings of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. So this particular mudra, you can see there are three, and that's turning the wheel of Dharma. So the first turning was really the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. So we also talk in this lineage, we talk about Hinayana as being on the path of individual liberation. So that's the first turning. But it's about suffering. You know, that's where the Buddha started. We hear that word a lot. The second turning, as Muffy said, so that's Mahayana.
Could you just
yes.
say what the Four Noble Truths are? Just
what do you want to say
quickly?
Okay.
No.
life is suffering, then there first is there is suffering. The second is the cause of suffering. The third is the path. And the fourth is the fourth is the path. Right. Yeah, it's confusing because you hit cessation before you hit the path.
I wanted to bring that up is just this profound acknowledgement that life is suffering actually exists is shocking in and of itself, is a shocking realization and for these early students and for us too. So it continues to be very loud, noble truth.
Thank you. That's really true, and it's very profound. So those first teachings on suffering, we're constantly working with an understanding of what that's all about and what that cause of suffering is. And we see that continue in the teaching of the Heart Sutra, because at the root, it's what is it that causes suffering? And that's kind of the hidden kernel within the Heart Sutra. And that's for us to find out. That's also why questions are so important. And you've never seen me write an outline that looked like this, which was just questions. So that's thanks to Shariputra, who's the person who asked the question. The question, Shariputra, he's the one in the Heart Sutra who asks the question and starts the wheel turning. So that's why questions are so important. So thus my little non-outline. So the second turning is Mahayana. Maha is great. Yana is vehicle. And emptiness is the main teaching there, and that's all phenomena are without self nature, and we'll go into that more during the study of the Heart Sutra. The third turning of the wheel of Dharma is also within Mahayana, and that's the teachings of Buddha nature, and that is about the fact that all sentient beings possess this Buddha nature or this potential for enlightenment within. So that's the third turning. And as you know, Mahayana is the great vehicle. So when we talk about Mahayana, there are two parts that are really important to know about. And I must say also, it's almost like the language is a code. And once you start to read the code, then you can expand it. It's sort of like whatever that those plants you put in water and they expand, these things that kind of grow. So the Mahayana is the great vehicle. So it's said that the Mahayana is profound. So if you think of the ocean, you could say deep. It's deep. And those are the teachings on emptiness. Very, very profound. And it's vast. Do you know what the vast part would be?
There's nothing untouched by the doctrine of emptiness.
That's true.
Everything is.
But actually, when we talk about vast, in this case, we're talking about compassion, compassionate activity. So those are the two components that are really key in the Mahayana, which is deep, profound, and that's the view of emptiness and the understanding of emptiness. What is that? And the activity, the compassionate activity, is vast. So when we talk about the four immeasurables, it's immeasurable. Love and we talk about love and compassion and joy and equanimity. It's without any limits. So that's the vast activity.
Which is the Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm.
So compassion, Buddha nature, is the third turning. Yeah.
What I thought was so helpful when some of us took the Bodhisattva vows that Nietzsche Mark said, sometimes it's hard to imagine like what would it look like to be compassionate, to to everyone, because like that's a lot of people to keep track of in your head. I love the way he said, another way to think about it is there's not a single being left behind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when you have that moment of like, yes, I'm compassionate to everybody, but that person, I'm a teacher, I have that person who's really hard to be compassionate to. And every day I think, oh, Major Mark made me promise to be compassionate even to that person.
Right, right. Yeah.
The other thing I like in this book, it says that, talking about vast, is that it's inexpressible and inconceivable, but it does not mean that it is completely inaccessible.
Right.
That's very key. So it's inconceivable, but there still is a path that leads to, that leads us to eventually experiencing the very same realization.
Right. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Excellent. It's not hopeless.
Right.
Even though it may seem like it's so much. But there is a way in, and that's what the Heart Sutra is.
On top of that, I have been struggling for a while with the concept of mind, because there's the mind, which is discerning things, right?
Right.
And causing judgment. But then the mind is also the path. So there's the mind, which is kind of Buddha nature. So there's the potential there. But the same thing, same time, it's also the obstacles along the way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So this is really interesting kind of trying to, because we are so used, or I am so used to concrete definitions. This is what the mind is. It's not this.
Right.
Right. But now I'm trying to wrap my head around the idea of this, something that is at the same time that it's the obstacle, it's also the path. It's just also the potential.
That's all that the Heart Sutra says.
Yeah.
Right.
It's this and then it's not that.
Right.
At the same time.
Right.
And in fact, that's the whole path right there.
I mean,
there'd be no path with no lotus coming, being able to be born except for the muck and mud underneath, and that's, we've got ourselves to work with. So without this muddy, mucky me, where would we begin? So that's so from the get-go.
Right.
I keep coming back to the word potential,
right,
over and over and over again. It's also what carries me through this when I'm really frustrated with it.
Yeah. Well, and we don't step on our thoughts, you know. We're not trying to really get rid of them. The thoughts are, that's the bubbling up of our intelligence, and that's a way in. So we take that intelligence, like prajna, and
pops the bubble.
And that moves us further into wisdom. So that's what Mike will be talking more about, the word prajnaparamita next time. So that prajna, it's transcendent prajna. So it becomes wisdom, because we understand that the emotions themselves are not bad. They actually contain the seed of wisdom. So everything contains that seed. And we start to see through, by clearing the obscurations, we start to see that come through, that wisdom shines through. So, that's good. So, all right, let's see. Number three. I don't know if this is, makes sense, but the first teachings of the Buddha were about suffering, which we just heard. Does the Heart Sutra present a way out of suffering? If so, how? Do you see anything in there?
Well, suffering and no suffering are both dispensed with in the Heart Sutra. There is no suffering and there is no end of suffering, which I take to mean there is, that what we take to be suffering doesn't have any self-nature of itself. It is not... It doesn't actually exist in an absolute sense. There is relative suffering. There's suffering in a relative world. But ultimately, there's no suffering. And since there's no suffering, there can't be any end of suffering.
Right.
And that same logic is applied to
all
most things.
Across, so, yeah. All across. And I remember, I think Sandra posted this for people, the talk by Pema Chodron on groundlessness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what struck me about that talk was the line that she said when she heard this line, then she really got curious about the Heart Sutra. Since there is no obscuration of mind, there is no fear. And she said, well, this looks like a possible way to understand my own suffering and the liberation from suffering. So this obscuration of mind, and Michael will talk more about that, it's like the clouds that cover the sun, and the sun is your wisdom mind, your Buddha mind, and those obscurations are that's our confusion. But as we can understand, and as you presented about suffering, that we understand what that suffering is and what that confusion is, then that can be cleared away. And then it says there is no fear. So there's it could be a big question mark. What is this?
That's my favorite line of the thing. Because if you have no fear, you are free.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
So that's the guy in the movie.
He said yes.
The same thing, he was afraid of was getting lost.
Right.
Really lost in Japan without the language, no money. And after that, he said, no.
Yeah, that was his. He had paranoia and fear about getting lost, and what happens when they first get there? They get lost, right? Right. So.
And then they go meditate.
So
I'd like to say I think the mantra is somehow a way out. Because all I know of the mantra is somehow the words beyond.
Yes.
And the mantra is a constant, motivation to go beyond. And like you talk about the freedom of the sun, the mind.
Yes.
Or going beyond all this obscurations is the mantra. And don't they say something in the thing about the unequaled mantra? Calms all suffering.
Yes. Yeah, Om Gate Gate, Om Gone,
yeah, so it's
Gone
it's
Beyond, Paragate, Gone Far Beyond, Bodhiswaha, Om Gate, Gone
beyond. Beyond the other shore.
Beyond to the other shore.
The other shore.
To the other shore.
Beyond.
Or beyond.
First it says
beyond.
Beyond. And gate, gate means gone, and then paragate means gone beyond.
Gone beyond.
Parasangate means gone beyond even the notion of being gone.
Gone way beyond.
Totally.
Way beyond. Bodhiswaha. So I think you make a good point there, Harry Bob, that the mantra itself is definitely about liberation and going beyond. So when you actually chant this at home, you can pause at the mantra and recite it several times or whatever you wish. So it's up to you.
Do you remember at the retreat that we went to, one of the teachers was talking about how some students just hear the mantra and they get it, and he said, like, Om Gate Gate Paragate,
oh, I got it. Right. All right, this may be kind of strange, but anyway, you know me, I'm kind of strange. So,
we love that.
I have to say that there might be another answer in terms of a way out of suffering. And if you go to the department store perfume counter, you might find it. Now, I have been saving this for a really long time.
Emily!
I've been dying to show you this.
This is your way out of suffering.
This is a way out of suffering. So, Michael ordered men's cologne, and he received this bag.
Oh, wow.
And
he received that bag.
He received the bag. And I received, and of course I took this, because I thought this is the Dharma in a nutshell. Okay? Okay, so we're talking about how to get out of suffering. You just go to the You go to the perfume counter, and you could buy euphoria. Provocative, masculine, and sexy. You could buy, let's see, we have eternity for men.
Because women don't get eternity.
We don't have this. Want it. But
my favorite is eternity now. And now is in big letters. Caps. Eternity now. A juicy oriental fougere. A youthful burst of energy balanced with exotic woods. So I would say that what are we afraid of is death. Right? And where do you go to get away from death?
Right there.
You go for eternity now. And if you go to the perfume counter, you know, there was one called Samsara. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
There's a perfume called Samsara.
Oh, I just want to swim that one.
And I think we probably should go on a field trip.
Awesome.
But now I can do something with these and I can give them away. But actually, there are two more. This, I think, must be the gay men's version. It's pink. It's a bright crystal, and it's all sorts of flowers and things inside. And then, well, there's aqua. This is for the guy in the water. So there you go. Anyway, I couldn't help myself, and I'm saving that for my
aqua ocean. Ocean. Oh,
there you go.
Dharma.
Ocean
there
of Dharma. Right.
Show him something.
So there you have it. Okay, the antidote to fear is eternity now. So you can, you'll never forget that. Okay, so let's see. Where are we? Oh dear.
By Calvin Klein.
Okay, Calvin Klein will help.
You writing that one down?
It's the path. I want to know how to get there.
Yeah, really.
Smell it.
Okay, we're only on number four, and we I don't know how much we've learned here yet. the no words of the... What's that?
No attainment.
No attainment. Okay, good.
That's reassuring.
That's reassuring. Okay, the words of the Heart Sutra don't make any sense. How can you use words to go beyond concepts? Okay, all right, so now we have the book. We should look at the book after all. Okay, page 17. We use words to become free from words until we reach the pure wordless essence. Okay, that sounds good. So the Heart Sutra does go beyond concept, and it goes beyond, you could say it goes beyond the rational mind, although it sounds in some ways, well, I mean, that's why Carl starts out by saying it's sounds crazy. It does sound crazy. And actually, it really can't be taught by words because you have to discover it yourself, right? So if you really think about what happened in the beginning of the Heart Sutra, so it was just interesting in looking at this again. You know, what does the Buddha do? At that time, the Blessed One entered the samadhi that expresses the Dharma called profound illumination. So this is really, I think, the first clue to understanding the Heart Sutra. The Buddha is actually showing the way in to understanding what this is about. And what does he do? He goes into a deep samadhi, which is meditation. So that's your first clue. How do you actually make sense of this? You actually have to practice meditation and find that for yourself. And then the second clue, I think, is the phrase that expresses the Dharma. So he didn't say anything. He just sat down. And he was, by his power, basically causing the Dharma to be taught, and others taught it. So the great Bodhisattva, Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, who is the Bodhisattva of compassion, and actually the Dalai Lama is a manifestation of Avalokiteshvara, as well as the Karmapa, who's head of the Kagyu lineage. They're both said to be emanations of Avalokiteshvara. So the Buddha says nothing here until the very, very end, where he just says, good job, thanks. That was thanks, I'll go back to my meditation. So by example, that's why we don't worship the Buddha. The Buddha is an example of someone who attained liberation. So this chant...
Avalokiteshvara didn't say anything until...
Until...
What?
What happened?
Shariputra asked a question.
That's it. Right?
Good old Shariputra.
Good old Shariputra. So that caused the
He's
Dharma.
One of us.
Right. So that's what turns the wheel of Dharma. That's what turns the wheel of Dharma, the question. Because the teacher never knows what answer to give until they know where the student is and what their question is. So you see, it's a dialogue. It's a reciprocal approach. There's not a set of beliefs in Buddhism. So it's a self-discovery program. So so the words here under profound illumination, that expresses the Dharma called profound illumination. So we discuss the word profound, and that's deep, or you could say emptiness. And the illumination part is, you could say, this prajna, the mind, illumination we used, you know, I saw the light, that that also translates into the light as spreads everywhere, it's compassionate activity. So that's those two words, profound illumination, you could contemplate that and really discover what that is for yourself. But I propose here that it's the combination of emptiness and compassion, which is the heart of this teaching.
I thought it was interesting that in the other his translation it's different.
What does he say?
At that time, if Bhagavan entered the samadhi of the enumerations of phenomena called perception of the profound. End quotes. Perception of the profound.
Mm-hmm. Perception of the profound.
Well, insight. Perception.
That's profound insight. Yeah. Yeah.
Illumination.
Yeah. It's a different way of saying it.
You're going to read, there are hundreds of translations.
And different lengths. Well, he says that too. You know, there's as much as one word, right? And then thousands of words. So this is a fairly short, little, concise bit here. Number five, all these no's sound very negative. Why isn't Avalokiteshvara more positive? What do you think of that?
Proof by contradiction.
Go ahead, say more.
It's just that, you set up a bunch of circumstances and go, nope, that doesn't work. There's a contradiction. It's a sort of mathematical technique. And all of the premises and grounds of our normal existence, you wind up with, they're inconsistent. It doesn't work.
Yes.
Yeah. There's an inconsistency, or at the core of that, and that I think of that as. That's the way I read the sequence of no's.
Yes, that's excellent. And that has to do with the analytical meditation that we've worked with. And that is another way in terms of understanding what the fundamental truth of the Heart Sutra is. The world that we see and perceive, and the things, the way we construct, starting with the skandhas, the five skandhas, the way we construct the self, we have a misperception or a misunderstanding.
I think a lot of the analytical meditation techniques just to show that, this isn't the whole story, and to sort of explore, really the way we're constructing the world, there's something that doesn't work. And
right.
Just keep doing that
right.
Over and over.
Yeah, right. And we don't actually question that. You know, we have our reality and we kind of know the way things are and the way they work. But this says, wait a minute here, this isn't actually the way it's happening. Yeah.
He says, beings suffer due to their clinging to things as existing in the way they appear.
Yes.
So it's kind of just saying, that's what they look like, that's what they seem like, let's get past that.
Right, right. And really exploring what that means.
But then the other thing he's doing with the nose is he's saying, you think this is the way in? No.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's the way in. Nope. And it's sort of every time you feel like that idea of trying to get a little ground under your feet, because we don't like that, not having ground.
Right.
Nope, that's not the ground. So it's the opposite. No, that's not the ground.
Right.
You know, in Pema's thing where she's like,
you, beautiful.
You know, when you go and you study and the Buddha asks you, what if the Buddha asks you this? And say, oh, it's this.
Right.
No.
No.
Like that thing. I just realized now each time she says, the Buddha says, no.
No. All the way down the list.
Yeah.
No. So we don't cling to any of those things.
Right. We don't cling to all these, any of those things. Say more. Right. Say more. That's right.
I think it was just like that. Just so that no point you say, "Oh, I've got it now.
Right.
It is this."
Right.
Yeah. That,
right.
It's just like to try to pull the rug out from under your feet each time.
Right. Right. So I guess my example of what that is, and I had to text my daughter in California for this. I said, "Okay, so what track did Harry Potter use to get to Hogwarts?"
Nine and three quarters.
Okay, so she's reading to my grandson the, you know, Harry Potter. He's on the last book by now. But
how did he have to find? What did he have to do to get track 9 3/4?
To run through a wall.
Wow.
Brick wall.
Yeah. He had to have the confidence to go into the wall. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just something was there that was obviously not there.
Beyond concept.
Just not assuming the wall is solid.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's a great example in terms of Majjhimaka is going between. It's not this, it's not that, and it's not this concept, it's not that concept. It's not here, it's not there. But it's in between all of that. So you have to really ask yourself, what's that mean, in between? Then that means maybe the whole structure is faulty somehow. So it's not like we knock down the walls and, you know, destroy the house off the bat, you know, right off the bat. But when you start to question, then you have to start looking and asking. When you say, I don't feel like myself today, well, which self are we talking about? And how can you not feel like yourself if you're the one thinking about yourself? So where is this person anyway? So those kinds of things, it's like you have to start asking questions. So that's what this is. The Heart Sutra fundamentally is, how can you ask questions that are going to pull the rug out from your own feet? Even if, you know, we'll try to do it here together as a group, but fundamentally, you have to understand this on your own. That's really the message, I think, here.
What do you think about the idea of emptiness being like a really deep understanding of temporary?
That's part of it.
Well, but you're
saying
it's a thing. You're already getting trapped when you start trying to designate emptiness as anything at all, no matter how subtle and how abstract and how even transcendent. Our mind has a tendency to reify anything we talk about. It doesn't only have to be, you know, obvious.
I'm just trying to add into emptiness as being that if everything is really temporary, you can't pin it. You can, because the moment you try to pin it, it's something else. It's,
well, we're doing it anyway.
Try that on your teacher.
Kondor Rinpoche.
Yeah.
See how far you get.
I'll do that.
Well, that's one way in, because emptiness, like looking at the impermanence, is that's part of it. You know, that everything's constantly changing. That's part of it too.
Yeah.
But it goes beyond that in terms of how we perceive the world, how we construct ourself, and even though we can understand, like we have just had that teaching on the five skandhas, then we can maybe talk about it, but then there's more to it, I think, to really understand that what it means to actually not add up. The five skandhas don't add up to a self.
I would be cautious about having any one definition of emptiness, no matter how plausible it seems.
Yeah.
I think also.
Okay,
it's a contradiction because fundamentally emptiness is completely open. And that's another word for it, which is actually open. In many ways
space.
More characteristic or helpful. Openness, because it is so inconceivably open that there's no way you can put any kind of limits on it. And the minute you start defining anything at all, no matter how far out you think you've gotten it or reached somewhere, you know, you're still somehow locating something and you've lost it. So it's subtle. And this is one of the characteristics that it is so, it's like the skin on our face is so much here that we totally take it for granted. I mean, of course, you can look in the mirror and get excited about whether it works or not, but that's different. It's just basically the space we experience is so constantly present that we cannot understand what it is. It's too simple. It's too beyond the capacity of mind under any circumstances to grasp. It's not graspable.
No.
And that's what we're training in, is learning how to not grasp, learning how to actually explore this dimension.
Hang out in space. Basically.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to do, though, is see emptiness is not just the concept of what I have in my head of what emptiness is. It can be, it's many.
It's anything.
That's, I guess, my
it's
point,
anything.
Is trying to point to all the different definitions we could come up with, ideas we can come up with, concepts of it, but they really are all saying the same thing. We just can't say it.
You can't say where your mind is. You can't find mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, even though it's going, you use it all the time. It's using you.
Yeah.
It's using us. But we can't find it.
Yeah.
Right.
Khandra Rinpoche has a great talk on that.
Oh, also Khandra Rinpoche, Khandro. We'll put a link, I think, on this. She has a talk on the Heart Sutra. That's really, really, really good.
Okay.
So I recommend that everyone listen to that. It's excellent. Yes?
I think I'm probably repeating some of everything that has just been said.
It's okay.
The way, in terms of looking at the Heart Sutra and trying to get to, you know, one's own personal definition of whatever, I think it's more about the fact that you have the opportunity to catch yourself in the grasping, you know, and to be in the questioning. That I think is perhaps part of what this is about. That it's not, because it's very easy, I find. In fact, we were talking the other day. You know, I think sometimes Buddhism can attract people who are just very bright, you know, and very, like, in their heads and stuff. It's very interesting to go there. And and the thing is that it's kind of like this tangle that you keep on following it and you find you're right back from where you began.
Yeah.
That's it.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so it really, that's the way that I'm looking at this. And so maybe because also I'm good at kind of going, okay. You know, like I'm not so, I don't know.
Linear.
Yeah, I'm totally not linear.
Right. I got that about you.
And, that actually, if I just hang with this, and for me, when it talks about, like, it's beyond language, I take that literally.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I listen to how the sounds of the language and the rhythms
mm-hmm.
play on me.
Yeah.
You know, even that stuff. I mean, that's what I get out of it.
And also, we in Mahayana, we move into a different way of using language. It's very symbolic. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the Bodhisattva vow, you know, the bridge, you know, just all these imagery, simile, metaphor, all of that. So it's a more visual, and the imagery starts to get more vivid, I'd say, in the Mahayana. So that's a clue, too, because we're making associations. So we talk about the lotus. Okay, so the image of a lotus may not mean a lot to us. Living in New England, we don't really see too many. Although we have them out in the pond. Yeah, we have them out there. We have the American lotus. Yeah, we do have the water lily. But what is the imagery of a lotus? It grows in the mud, and it comes out of the mud, and then it opens petal by petal by petal. So it's about, so it has to do with the mind can be cloudy and full of concept or confusion, and this beautiful flower of the wisdom of the mind opens. But it comes out of the mud, and we're all in the mud. And yet that wisdom potential is there.
May confusion dawn as wisdom.
And may confusion dawn as wisdom. And the sun is something Michael will talk about next week, too. The sun and clouds. So there's a lot of imagery that has a very deep meaning, and you start to see what the imagery is saying and how it carries through from text to text in different readings. So it's like a hidden language almost. When you start to understand it, you go, oh, I get that. All right, I see. The rays, radiance.
Okay. But all of these are the finger pointing.
Uh-huh.
To the,
right.
None of them is the it.
Yeah.
And that's what you're mentioning. You're talking about is that we all, and Michael, you were saying, we all grasp on, like, this is the it.
Okay, it's a Lewis.
This is the, and so.
But if you get a lot of fingers pointing to the moon, and you're not holding on to the fingers, you might actually get towards the moon.
I'm not really confused.
But they actually,
different people look at the moon differently. You know what I mean? You can say it's this thing, and you know, it depends on.
Well, but you're not looking at the finger. You're looking at the moon. If you look at the finger, you're gonna have a very different approaches.
A million fingers.
Make a big deal.
That's the point.
Reflection in the water.
Right, exactly. So
reflection in the water.
So this was a sort of looser attitude.
Yeah, a looser attitude.
Being willing to have a looser attitude.
Try that.
Right. Don't pin everything.
It's right here.
Okay, that was an important thing that Erica just said. Part of this, the teaching is about having a looser attitude and don't pin everything down.
Yeah,
so that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The idea, the danger with the multiple fingers pointing to the moon is that when you use that physical metaphor, you assume it's going to be in exactly one place, and I think that's the wrong direction to be thinking about that. It's, you know, it's more that there are different ways of pointing. It doesn't mean that you're going to be able to fix it in one spot in the heavens. But
right. Yeah. If it helps, I can read this sentence.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. In this way, the Buddhist teachings are like fingers pointing at the moon. The problem is that if we get stuck on the fingers, we'll never see the moon. Just the Buddha provided a lot of potential fingers for 45 years, always pointing in that same moon, which is nothing other than the true nature of our mind. The reason why he used so many pointing fingers is that if a single person points to the moon with just one finger, we might miss it. But if many people point at the moon with many fingers from all kinds of directions, it's hard to miss the moon.
Very good. Good. Yes?
I have a question which is actually not Buddha related, but if it's called the Heart Sutra, doesn't it direct you to look in your heart, not in your mind?
Well, that's
the last question.
So the heart of transcendent wisdom, which is, you know, the most important part. So in Buddhism, they don't separate the mind here in the, you know, the head and the heart here, so feeling. So it's really heart mind here. So
on a felt level.
Yeah, on a felt level. I guess yes, you could see it that way, I think. Yeah.
That's what we actually were working with this past retreat in some way.
Uh-huh.
Was that exact thing.
Yeah.
The heart mind.
Heart mind. Yeah.
Heart mind. Yeah.
It's 9 o'clock.
Yeah. It is 9 o'clock. Yes. So.